interviewing Malcolm X in seventh grade. I wrote a paper on it. I got a C. You got to read that book more than once. And my mind was developed to the, what Brother Malcolm was putting down. But I come from a long line of educators and educated black folks. My father, Bill Lee, jazz bassist, who's done a lot of my scores in my films, was a freshman at Morehouse when Dr. Martin Luther King was a senior. My classmate, the illustrious class of Morehouse 79, is Martin Luther King III. My father went to Morehouse, my grandfather went to Morehouse, and my mother and grandmother went to Spelman. So we have to understand, we have a long line of educated black folks. As you said, sister, it was against the law for us to read and write. And we, you know, the day we had off on Sundays, that's what we do, you know, under the, you know, reading the Bible. But a master caught you, you get whipped, and we had a bad day, you'd be castrated and hung. Our ancestors risked their life because they understood that education was going to be the key. Our ancestors risked their life to be educated. We cannot let that go. So I'm gonna go to the film. That was the making of that film was the hardest thing I ever had to do. And the great Marvin Worth bought the rights from Dr. Betty Shabazz. Way back. And for 20-something years, he tried to get it made. Several directors, several actors, and finally, Norma Jewison was directed with Denzel. And when I heard that Norma Jewison was directing this, I said, hell to the nah. But here's the thing, though. I respect Norman Jewison because it was his job. He gracefully bowed out. He didn't have to do that. And so once we got that, I knew we had to do the film. But from the very beginning, we didn't have enough money. I put half my salary into the film. Warner Brothers knew it. We all knew it. But we're just going to go. I mean, this whole thing, and you know, in the studio system, you know, you got to get them impregnated. So we knew one day the money would run out. And Warner Brothers did not want the length of that film to be 3 hours. We knew it was not about ego to tell the many different lives that Malcolm led. We needed that time. We needed that time. And we went out, it's crazy. We showed the 4-hour version to Warner Brothers. 4 hours. We knew we could cut it down, but it was a day of the Rodney King verdict. So we're screening the film for Warner Brothers executives, the two presidents, and the secretaries are coming in and out because LA's burning. But to their credit, they stayed throughout the whole 4 hours. And so it was a long discussion because they had to, I think a helicopter came to Warner Brothers lot and took them to where they had to go. And they said, how long is the film to be? I said, how long is JFK? Because JFK was coming out. Right. And they said, JFK is 2 hours. They didn't know I know Oliver Stone. I call Alva, does Alva. How long was JFK? He says, Spike, it's 3 hours, but I won't tell them. I told you so. So we knew that we had to keep going. We did not cut the film, the length, and Warner Bros. Let the Bond Company take over the film. All the people in post-production got registered letters saying you're fired. As I said before, I already put half my salary already into the film. So it was the lowest point in my life, with the exception of my mother dying. And Malcolm came to me. Self-determination, self-reliance. I kept thinking about that again and again and again. What does that mean? And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. I know some black folks that got some money. So this was the plan. Not that I only know him, but I had that phone number. So I made a list. And here's the key thing. This was not, it was not, they're not, they couldn't get any money back. It wasn't a tax write-off. It just had to be like, here, take it. Take it. And the first person I called was Bill Cosby. Called him up, said, Bill, first thing he said was, how's Camille? Then I told him what it was about. He said, Spike, I'll put the check in the mail. I said, nah. I knew he lived in a townhouse up East Side. Knocked on the door. Didn't even come in. Snatched that check. Ran to the bank before he could change his mind. So I made a list. And I always get the order mixed up. A great woman, Pinky Cooper Kafritz. She wrote a check. Tracy Chapman. Janet Jackson. Prince. And then there were two left. So here's the other thing, though, is that every time I said yes, I was asking for more money. I was feeling it. So I had two people on my list. Called up Magic. Boom. And then the last call. The GOAT, who was born in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, not North Carolina, Michael Jordan, born in Cumberland Hospital on Myrtle Avenue, same hospital Mike Tyson and Bernard King were born, Bernard Albert King born. So, if you one thing about Michael, he don't like to lose nothing. Very competitive. So I just let it slip how much Magic gave. Oh, Miss Oprah Winfrey. Sorry. She's in there. I tell you, I get the. So I let Michael. I said, well, Magic gave. He said, Magic gave what? Boom. So now we had the money, and I had the money to rehire the crew. And at this time, there was no talking between myself and Warner Brothers, because Warner Brothers gave the film to the Bond Company. So, on this date, on Malcolm's birthday, we had a press conference at the Schomburg Library, 135th and Lenox, and we announced that these prominent African Americans wrote these checks. And the next day, Warner Brothers financed the rest of the movie. Wow. True story. And the movie is because of Denzel Washington. Denzel had done an off-Broadway play, When Chickens Come Home to Roost, many years. And there were many times when he was on camera, that our skin was crawling because we saw Malcolm. It was eerie. It was eerie. And there's one scene, all the speeches were Malcolm's speeches, and there's one scene where you see Al Freeman Jr. as Honorable Elijah Muhammad behind him. And so we're looking at this. Denzel is talking. I'm next to my great cameraman, Ernest Dickerson, and we're shooting film, so it's only 10 minutes in a roll of film. We're shooting 35 millimeter. So Denzel's going, I'm turning the page, he's killing it, and Ernest is telling me, Spike, we're about to roll out. And then I see that I'm reading the script, and this is where the scene's supposed to end, and he keeps going. And the stuff, we were all mesmerized. And finally, Ernest said, we rolled out. So I went up to Denzel, and his eyes were glazed over. His eyes were glazed over. Anybody was there, we saw the spirit of Malcolm. The spirit of Malcolm came over Denzel. But here's the thing, though. Denzel, he started working on that role a year before we even began to shoot. Stopped drinking. No more swine. No pork was on his fork. We're not talking about Shorty now. But learn how to pray. Read the Quran. He devoted his life to that role. So I'm not going to name no names. But a lot of these autobiographical films, you could put the makeup on and the hair, but that stuff is superficial. That performance happened because he put the work in. Denzel put the work in, and as Elashi said, it doesn't seem like 30 years, but that performance gets better every year. And it was a great travesty that Denzel did not win the Academy Award for that role. But let me break it down to you. In basketball, there's a thing called the makeup call. Everybody know what that is? When the referee sees a call, they don't call it, and then the next time, boom. One of the greatest actors ever, Al Pacino. Give it up for Al Pacino. He got nominated, but not win for Godfather, Godfather 2, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon. Al Pacino, he's from the Bronx too. Al Pacino's a true. So, he didn't win all those times. Denzel's young. He'll be back. He gets it. Denzel comes around again. Training day. Boom. But here's the thing as an artist. You cannot allow other people to determine. You know what I'm talking about, sister. You know what I'm talking about. We can't let other artists determine what our worth is. So, in closing, I'm honored to be here. And we all love... Oh, last thing. This is for you, my sister, Miss Shabazz. You! What? Listen! Oh, what does that mean? You took your glasses off. Okay. It's about your mother. During the pre-production of this film, I had several conversations with your mother. And she's responsible for one of the best scenes in the film. Ernest Dickerson, great cameraman. Ernest and I, he went to Howard, HU, you know. We came in NYU film school together. He went to Howard and went to Morris. Boom. Ernest shot all my films at NYU. She's going to have his school days, Do the Right Thing, More Better, Jungle Fever, than Malcolm X. And we doing this thing called a double dolly shot, where it looks like someone's floating. And so before we did Malcolm X, Ernest and I said, we just can't be using that stuff to show off. We've been out of film school many years. We have to have a reason to use that shot. And Dr. Betty Shabazz told me that she felt her husband knew he was going to be assassinated right here. She told me that. And when Dr. Betty Shabazz told me that, that's when I knew. That's where the double dolly shot had to be. You know the scene, Sam Cooke. What's he singing? Change of the Come. That's how that scene came to be. Dr. Betty Shabazz, thank you. Good night.
The Oscar-winning filmmaker Spike Lee speaking last Friday at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center, housed in the former Audubon Ballroom in New York, where Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965. Spike Lee was speaking on what would have been the 98th birthday of Malcolm X. When we come back, Memorial Day Massacre. Workers die, film buried. We look at the 1937 Memorial Day Massacre in Chicago. Stay with us.
By the river, in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Is going to come. Sam Cooke here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Memorial Day weekend begins here in the United States, we end today's show looking back at the largely forgotten 1937 Memorial Day Massacre, when police in Chicago shot at and gassed a peaceful gathering of striking steelworkers and their supporters, killing 10 people, most of them shot in the back. It was a time like today when unions were growing stronger. The workers were on strike against Republic Steel. The police attacked them with weapons supplied by the company. The tragic story is told in a new PBS documentary, Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. It's based on a book with oral histories of eyewitnesses of the attack. The film begins with the great radio broadcaster, Studs Terkel.
This is 1937. And the labor battles are going on. The CIO is being organized. And the steel workers and the packing are all being organized. And the big steel companies finally agreed. They recognized the union. But there's one company in Chicago, Republic Steel. Tom says, I will not recognize the union. And so there was a strike. Memorial Day, 1937, and there was a picnic. Strikers and their wives and kids are on the grounds of Republic Steel in South Chicago. Someone threw a stone, and cops were there at the behest of Durkin. And they shot down 10 people, killed them in the back.
In the days that follow, newspapers from coast to coast portrayed the incident as a riot provoked by a dangerous mob, which left police no choice but to open fire, with 10 dead within days. However, the key piece of evidence, the only film of the tragedy, remained buried. Paramount News created, then suppressed, a newsreel airing the footage. When the hidden footage was finally screened, the shocking images drew national attention, with vital lessons for today.
That's the opening to the new documentary Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. This is another clip. When eyewitness describes how the police attack unfolded, we hear from reporter Harold Rossman and Molly West, who was a teenager when she attended the Memorial Day gathering in support of the striking workers.
We just walked, and people were talking and holding hands, and the children were being carried by their fathers on their shoulders, and everybody was laughing, and it was a joyous thing. And as we came closer to the mill, the walking slowed a bit. It seemed like the entire police force of the city of Chicago was out there. But it didn't deter. We were still going to go over to the mill and just conduct a peaceful mass picket line.
I could see a few objects through the air. I could see some things being thrown. Not much. It wasn't a lot of stuff. Maybe a couple of rocks. There was a dry, crackling kind of a noise. It took me a moment to figure out what it was, and I realized it was gunfire. And by that time, the people were falling, and they were turning and trying to run, and the gunfire continued. It was clear that a whole number of these people had been shot in the back. They were trying to flee, and they were still being fired at.
And then a whole number of people were piled up on top of me, and I could barely breathe. Also, there was tear gas. People finally began to get on their feet. And when I finally stood up, in total bewilderment, I looked around and I saw a battlefield.
The new PBS documentary, Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried, which just aired on PBS, is now online. It's the latest project from longtime author and journalist Greg Mitchell, who's written 12 books and made many films about U.S. politics and history. Greg, welcome back to Democracy Now! This is a devastating documentary about a story very few people today know what happened 86 years ago in Chicago. Take it from where we have just heard these eyewitness descriptions. How did this happen?
Okay, well, I'm happy to be here. Yes, the police, in fact, shot 40 people, the vast majority in the back or in the side. 10 would die within days. And then they, as the film shows, they waded through the crowd, beating people over the head. Sometimes with axe handles provided by Republic Steel. And so there were another 50 people who were injured enough to be hospitalized. And then again, as the film shows, the injured, instead of getting any medical treatment, were actually arrested and shoved into paddy wagons and taken to jail or taken to distant hospitals. So, and this is all on the Paramount News footage, which was suppressed. So we know the step-by-step things that happened, and you can watch almost all the
Paramount.
Greg,
your film is so good. Greg, your film is so good, I want to go back to another clip from Memorial Day Massacre.
A disturbing new account of the death of one man emerged. A photo of Earl Hanley being carried by police, seemingly for medical attention, had appeared in newspapers earlier. Now, the full story came out. Hanley, a 37-year-old carpenter, had been shot in the thigh. So a worker tied a tourniquet on his leg to stop the bleeding. The Paramount footage showed him being hauled to a worker's car for a quick trip to the hospital. After the camera stopped rolling, however, police yanked him out of the car and carried him to their paddy wagon. As his tourniquet slipped off, and he bled to death. A doctor who treated some of the wounded presented autopsy reports proving that nearly all of the dead had been shot in the back or in the side.
And this is another clip from Memorial Day Massacre about how progressive Senator Robert La Follette subpoenaed the suppressed footage of the attack. This was the first time film was shown as evidence in a Senate hearing.
Senator La Follette announced that the footage would be screened at both regular speed and slow motion. Pointedly, he asked the top Chicago police officials to take a seat to view the film. This was reportedly the first time film footage had ever been introduced as evidence in Congress. The reaction in the hearing room: gasps, some tears, but stony silence from the top police officials. The slow motion revealed a murderous new detail. Much of the press coverage the next day now flipped to blaming the police, although many news outlets now claim that the camera could indeed lie.
It's what happened at South Chicago, Memorial Day 87.
Also the following day, Paramount, after burying the first two newsreels, at last released a film based on its footage.
The following pictures made before and during the trouble are shown exactly as from the camera, without editing, as presented before the United States Senate Committee in Washington.
The newsreel claimed that the footage was not edited, but this was false. Actually, it omitted this crucial footage, the deadly first 15 seconds. So Paramount was still withholding evidence from the public.
Another excerpt of Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. The director, Greg Mitchell, with us. I mean, this story of what the public understood happened with 10 people killed. Talk about the role of the media and the police working with it, whether the camera was shut off, as we saw in that first clip, or Paramount suppressing this, Greg.
Yes, the importance of it was the mass media, right up to the New York Times, was supporting the police story that they had no choice but to open fire on this mob. And Paramount had the footage, had the evidence. They created a newsreel, and then they decided not to release it. They created a second newsreel and didn't release that. And it took the being subpoenaed by the La Follette hearing and the screening on Capitol Hill, then forced Paramount to release a third newsreel. And even then, city officials in Chicago, in St. Louis, in Massachusetts, banned its showing. So even in its final form, it was not released in full.
And Greg, in this last minute, why is Paramount so significant? People might not understand that today. And what is the most important lesson to take of what took place?
Well, you know, as you know, the movies were incredibly popular then. This was before television. So most people got their visual news from these newsreels, which were shown in every movie theater, every movie showing. I think the lesson, among other things, is the importance of visual evidence when there's police shootings and police brutality, as we see today. And that's why there's such a focus on releasing body cams and dashboard cams. Of course, another lesson is with the great labor activity today, that they stand on the shoulders of the people from the past who sacrificed so much. And, that's why I'm happy. People can watch this film right now on PBS.org, everywhere in the country. And of course, the book has the oral histories of all eyewitnesses and many of the activists who were wounded.
Greg Mitchell, director of Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. And that does it for today's show. Thanks to Tia Potenza-Smallwood and Susan Hughes here in Cambridge. Also, thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Honey Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
Hello. This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Radio.